to have this once extinct species back in urban Greenford next to a McDonald's and a retail park has really captured people's imaginations, and we get people from all over London and beyond coming to see them.
Welcome to Wild Voices, a special series from Wild Tales of inspiring conversations about people, nature, and the stories that connect us. When community and nature come together, extraordinary things can happen. That's exactly what's unfolding at the Ealing Beaver Project in London, where local people are helping bring wildlife back to the city. In this episode of Wild Voices, Ajay Tagala joins Sean McCormack live at the Global Bird Fair to explore the power of rewilding, the future of conservation, and why making nature accessible in our towns and cities matters more than ever.
Hello, and welcome to this special Wild Voices episode of Wild Tales from the National Trust. It's wonderful to be live here at Global Bird Fair. And I'm Ajay Tagala, nature communicator and National Trust ranger on Britain's very first nature reserve, Wicken Fen, where I help safeguard important wetland bird populations. And today I'm very excited to be discussing nature and belonging with Sean McCormack. Sean is a vet, a conservationist, founder of the Ealing Wildlife Group, and a leading advocate for community-led urban rewilding. As project lead for the Ealing Beaver Project, he has helped spearhead the first beavers to be reintroduced to urban London in over 400 years. So welcome, Sean.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ajay. It's great to chat. Yeah. You know I love to.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I thought we'd start really at the beginning, actually, your kind of background. So your earliest nature memories, how it all started for you.
Yeah. So I think like many people here just was naturally, I don't know if it's genetic nature or nurture, but naturally just fascinated with living things. So plants and animals and bugs and all sorts. Probably came a little bit from my dad, and my grandparents were gardeners and, you know, very connected with outdoors. So I just was fascinated with kind of living creatures. And anyone who asked me what I wanted to be when I was a tiny kid, when I grew up, it was a zookeeper or a vet. So I ended up becoming a zoo vet.
Right.
And that's how stubborn I am. I wanted to get an idea in my head. And yeah, I just branched out in recent years then to kind of diversify my career and go move more into nature conservation and rewilding, urban rewilding in particular, where I live in London.
So that felt like a natural kind of progression, something that kind of called to you.
Yeah, it did. I kind of realized that veterinary, as amazing a kind of vocation as it is, it didn't really suit me. You know, it wasn't going to suit me full time, long term. I was getting a little bit jaded. I was getting a little bit bored. You know, I was basically, my whole working life, long hours, was in a small windowless consultation room under fluorescent lights and dealing with a carousel of, you know, people's emergencies and problems with their pets, some of them quite pampered pets. And I thought, hang on, this kind of wasn't what I envisaged when I was a kid. I wanted to be outdoors. I wanted to be exploring nature. I really was like, you know, passionate about ecology and nature and how nature worked. And actually a lot of things in the pet world especially are kind of going against nature. It's how we're selectively breeding pedigree dogs and they're suffering for their exaggerated appearance and things like that. So I was also dealing with exotic pets and kind of coming around to the conclusion, which is pretty obvious, that a lot of these species are not really suited to lives in captivity. And I felt like that wasn't my vocation. And I kind of thought back to who was I as a kid? Where was that passion? Where was that, like, what was that thing that made my heart sing? And it was wild creatures in their wild habitats doing their wild things. And I got a bit burnt out and I took, I'd say in hindsight, a very brave step, but I thought it might have been a very foolish step to step away from full-time clinical life and try and reconnect with that childhood passion, which was nature in nature. And looked around in Ealing trying to kind of find if there was some conservation group or something I could join. There wasn't, so I sort of half by accident set it up myself, and it's grown into a massive behemoth organization, which is brilliant and has built a lot of community. But I always joke to say the veterinary work that I still do pays the bills and the conservation makes my heart sing.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
And of course, Ealing Beaver Project grew out of that. So yeah. Can you talk us through that, sort of how that began?
Yeah. So Ealing Wildlife Group, we set up just to run a few bat walks and to do a few kind of nature engagement projects in the borough. And we gradually grew and got more volunteers and then got more grant funding and set up fairly traditional conservation projects for things like swifts in the urban landscape, hedgehogs with hedgehog highways. We have great crested newts. Then a lot of raptor species and owls, so barn owls and peregrine falcons and things like that, that we could influence in the urban landscape. The rewilding side of things really started to happen. I was quite interested in it during my undergrad degree in animal science. I did a project on the possibility of bringing beavers back to Britain, like, you know, 20 odd years ago. And then beavers came back into my kind of life, I suppose, when I went to Vancouver and studied there and saw there was beavers in Stanley Park in Vancouver. And that was a bit of a light bulb moment of, oh, beavers can be in urban areas too and be in cities, you know. And then we jokingly, we were talking about water vole restoration in Ealing. And I said, look, before we do anything with water vole reintroduction, let's practice first with harvest mice. Mm-hmm. So I said that harvest mice would be our little practice run. And you never know, one day we've reintroduced Britain's smallest native rodent. One day we might reintroduce Britain's largest native rodent, the beaver. And everyone laughed and said, oh, as if we'd ever have beavers in Ealing, let alone London. And who is laughing now, AJ? Because we do, we have them. So we just really got a brilliant community behind us. We'd proven ourselves with the local council. They trusted that we could do it. We were basically saying that beavers would be a natural, nature-based solution to urban flooding. And we could save the council money because they'd earmarked Paradise Fields, the site of the project, for engineering works for flooding. And we were very, very lucky, Ajay, that we had a Canadian head of parks at the time. And when we asked him, could we bring beavers back? He was like, yeah, okay. You know, he was all aboard the beaver train already. So that's where it came from. It kind of was a build up, and it's been our biggest and boldest project, I suppose, to date. But it's been a roaring success. It's been great.
Yeah. And that community involvement, really so important.
We couldn't do it without the community. You know, we had to do a public consultation, and we had to ask the community if they would support it and get behind it. We also had to ask the community if they would come and volunteer for us. And we are so lucky, you know, between us as project partners, Ealing Wildlife Group, also Citizen Zoo, our project partners, Friends of Horsenden, who are a community farm, we already had three ready-made groups of volunteers that were just really willing to go. And when we said we were going to bring beavers back and we wanted them to help do it, the offers, you know, were flooding in. People were so willing to help, to the extent that for the first year of the beavers being on site, we had a pair of volunteers do a fence patrol every single morning for the first year to make sure the fence was intact, the beavers were safe, nothing bad had happened overnight. Absolutely phenomenal. We couldn't do it without it. You know, we're managing the project through community WhatsApp groups, and basically whatever we ask people to do, they'll come down and do it at a moment's notice. So it really, really is the power of community and volunteering that has helped that project get off the ground and to be maintained as well and be a roaring success. Yeah, couldn't do it without them.
Yeah, so important. And of course, fantastic for those involved and those that know people that are involved and can kind of get involved that way through sort of knowing the right people. But of course, you know, we're talking about some amazing species in urban areas, and there must be a lot of people that aren't aware. And I suppose a challenge is kind of reaching those people that haven't found it yet.
Yeah, yeah. It's still funny to me that, you know, we've made such a big song and dance about it, and it's all I've bloody talked about for 5 years, you know. Beavers, 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 beavers. But there's people that walk through that site, Paradise Fields, and don't know that beavers are living there. So, you know, there's a lot of hesitancy in some certain kind of camps about beavers and not wanting beavers back in the landscape because they might cause us some nuisance effects, or getting used to something new is often daunting for people. But it just shows that actually this is a native species that can just sink back in, melt back into the landscape where it's meant to be. And a lot of people just don't even realize it's there doing its thing. But what it's doing, if you look closely, is fantastic work, boosting the kind of food webs from the base up, improving water quality, capturing carbon, mitigating for drought at this time of year when everything is bone dry and Paradise Fields is this lush oasis, you know, with wetlands. You'll know.
That's a powerful message. Yeah, it really is.
And then mitigating for flooding, you know, saving. If you were to believe all of the hype that we've got lately when we've gone viral, these five beavers we reintroduced have saved the entire London Underground from flooding. In fact, they've saved Greenford Tube Station Ticket Hall from flooding, but it makes a better headline to say they've saved the London Underground. But yeah, they're just fantastic. And it's been really heartening to see the reception they've got from the community. Community members who wouldn't have come to, you know, do some pond habitat management for great crested newts or come on a bird walk or come and count butterflies, actually to have this once extinct species back in urban Greenford next to a McDonald's and a retail park has really captured people's imaginations. And we get people from all over London and beyond coming to see them or even just see signs of what they've been doing, you know.
Mm. I want to talk also about people that perhaps feel excluded from nature.
Yes.
Kind of, especially young people as well, engaging yeah. people. I know that's a big part of what you do as well.
Massive part. And I think one of the things we always have talked about in Ealing Wildlife Group is that we don't want to only focus on the areas of the borough where we know there's a good kind of heartland of people interested in nature, people who maybe are affluent enough to experience nature, have the time off to go and seek it out. We know the nature sector is dominated by white middle-class people of a certain age, and that is exactly the case in the early days of Ealing Wildlife Group and who was interested in us. They were the easy wins to bring on board. But what we wanted to do is try and get to areas of the borough where there was little green space and show the value of it, you know, so putting on free events, trying to get families, trying to hook kids in and harness their pester power, which I've talked about in my children's book, and really open up kids' eyes to things that are all around them because maybe they haven't had access to that before. And certainly with the Ealing Beaver Project, one of the fundamental principles of it that we were very keen on and not willing to let go at the start, despite Natural England being wary of, was we wanted to put people into the beaver enclosure. Uh-huh. And that hadn't been done before. So we're the only beaver enclosure trial in Britain that is freely publicly accessible 24/7, 365. And I said, especially like with Elliot from Citizen Zoo, we don't want beavers on one side of a fence and people on the other. That has been done to death. I disagree fundamentally with enclosures as it is at this point in time now, because they're a native protected species. They need to be out there. But I understand why. I said, if we're going to do this at great cost of time and energy and finance as well, we're going to do it to push the envelope and do something different. And we want this to be accessible to all. So from the very get-go, we were doing free tours, free guided tours of the project for anyone to come down and see what the beavers are doing. It's free for anyone to come down anytime without a guide and see for themselves as well. So that was really at the heart of it. And then we also secured funding, which is brilliant, for an urban beaver officer. We believe the only one in Britain as well, another first. Shenez Mustafa, who you know, I think.
Yes, I do.
Shenez has been doing an incredible job bringing in people from different faith groups, people from different kind of backgrounds, some schools and outreach with schools and scouts groups from areas that aren't so kind of affluent and things like that, and basically giving kind of accessible education and engagement with nature on a very basic level to kids who really don't know much about it. And it's been remarkable to see the reaction to that, because I think fundamentally all of us as kids are fascinated with the natural world. We just grow out of it for various reasons, and some of those reasons are social justice reasons. So that's what we're trying to really put at the heart of all of our projects, that they need to be accessible to all. It can't be just, you know, private tours and pay your way and we don't have time. We're really investing in making sure people have that time and have that ability to come.
That's so important, so important. And I guess looking to the future with the success of what you've achieved and how it's grown over time, if we kind of like look to, say, 50 years ahead and imagining what Britain will be like, based on the success of Ealing Beaver Project, do you have a vision for what a wilder sort of future Britain could look like?
I do. I fantasize all the time about that.
I thought you might, yeah.
Look, I think when we talk about nature restoration and we talk about rewilding, you know, often people's immediate thought is like out there in the wilderness. We need huge landscapes that are rewilded and we need nature connectivity and ecosystems functioning normally and all that. And there can be a little bit of snobbery or puritanism around the scale that we have to get to. And I think that's great. And that's certainly the ambition we need to have. But we also can't forget that 83% of people live in towns and cities, and that in towns and cities, often nature is fragmented and it's chopped up into tiny little bits. And the sum of all its parts is much more important than each individual part. And we see it all the time in Ealing, you know, like just development chipping away at little blocks and little bits. So my vision for the future is that nature is not the preserve of, you know, the countryside, the rural folk, the large, wild, huge landscapes. Nature needs to be woven into everywhere we live. And that will take, you know, changes in urban planning and changes in developers' psyche and what we either ask developers to do or force them to do legally, you know, through various schemes and incentives. I would like to see that we have green spines running through every town and village and city across the nation. I would like to see that there's functioning ecosystems running through the urban landscapes as well as through rural landscapes. I would like to see that in the rural landscape that farming becomes a little less adversarial with nature and the conservation sector, and that the conservation sector becomes less adversarial with farmers. You know, these two groups should not be at loggerheads, should not be fighting each other. Like, farmers love and know nature too, and often they've been forced into economic models that have forced them to rinse everything they can from the land and farm up to the edges of nature all the time. So we need to actually develop systems that are more harmonious and that will weave nature through our lives wherever we live. That's my vision for the future. And wild things back, not being afraid to bring back the likes of harvest mice, you know, pretty innocuous, but water voles and beavers and pine martens and white storks and eagles. And, you know, let's get those species back. Let's get those iconic species back that actually get the non-nature nerds to sit up and notice exactly what thriving ecosystems look like.
Absolutely, yeah. And even in our homes as well, of course, like, I mean, swift bricks, of course.
Yeah. So many things people can do, yeah. And I'm from a bit of a background in garden design as well. I paid my way through vet school as a gardener and garden designer. That was my first foray into TV, was on a garden design show. And I think the garden industry, you know, could improve a lot as well. You know, we're still seeing these floor to ceiling shelving in garden centres of toxic chemicals and poisons to kill everything that you don't want in your garden. I think we need to see as gardeners that our gardens are part of those little island stepping stones in the landscape for species to cling on and to spread out from. So I would like to see a big shift in how we garden as well, and bringing back native plant communities into our gardens rather than just all these blousy exotic ornamentals that look really good but provide nothing for the insects and the food chain that is needed for everything else. People wondering, you know, putting up swift boxes of, where are all my swifts gone? Well, where are all the insects gone? That's the question. The insects can't be there if we all just choose species of shrub and plant from all over the world that doesn't feed the native insects, native plant communities. So yeah, I'd like to see everyone kind of joining the dots a bit better and saying, actually, we need nature back in every little patch of land we have, you know.
Exactly. And it starts with awareness, doesn't it? I mean, for example, peat-free compost, that's risen in people's awareness. And so that is a change that's come through.
Yeah.
But you're so right with pesticides. And you say joining the dots, I mean, butterfly decline.
Yeah.
And obviously the caterpillar habitat that's been decimated over the years.
The garden centre is like, plants for pollinators. It's like, yeah, that's going to give the adults a drink, but it's not going to raise their young, you know? So, yeah, I think it is about education. You know, we can be kind of all high and mighty here with knowledge on this thing. But I think once you start empowering people to get involved themselves, and that's what we've seen with Ealing Wildlife Group, the word spreads and it doesn't take long. I think it's something like 3.5% of the population change their mind on something significant. It starts to then snowball into general consensus and acceptance of that's the way forward. We see it with different things. You see, you know, the smoking ban, if we want to use a kind of sociological thing. You see it with, you know, I think at the moment, AstroTurf, grass lawns, you know, on social media, hugely aspirational for like young couples and the outdoor room. But now you're starting to see the comments turn on social media into, oh my God, plastic grass. It's almost become like smoking indoors. Like, ooh, who would have that? You know, so these things change with just gentle, kind of gradual accumulations of opinions getting out there. And I think advocating for it in a way that doesn't ostracize people, it doesn't like judge people too harshly. I don't always get it right, by the way. Sometimes I'm a bit annoyed and have a little riot act. But no, I think just trying to gently educate people to think about nature more in whatever way they can, you know.
And of course, your book, wonderful title, Beaver Believers, that's part of that process, isn't it? Starting with youngsters.
It is. Yeah. Beaver Believers is really about putting the three central characters, Abby, Patrick and Jacob, the kids, at the heart of the idea of the Ealing Beaver Project. So it's loosely based on that. But their school floods and they decide to convince the adults that bringing beavers back would be part of the solution. And I'm doing a talk about the book, but it's only a little bit about the book. It's mainly about how we all, as naturalists, bird watchers, lovers of this planet, how we all can try to use our influence to really inspire the next generation of nature lovers who are up against it. You know, they're detached. They're living in a technological age. You know, there's a lot of loss of knowledge of nature in the generations coming up. So I think we all have a duty to try and inspire and try and bring back that childlike wonder that we all had and instill it in the kids in our lives. So that's what the talk is about.
And you mentioned technology there. Mm. And actually, obviously, it's a challenge. It's a big part of life. But obviously, technology has the power to shape conservation as well. So have you any thoughts on kind of that, especially with young folks?
Yeah, I think it's brilliant. I think I'm becoming into that old technophobe category compared to the young people who are doing incredible things. And I'm like, oh, yeah, OK, I'm an old fogey now. I don't know how that works or I don't have patience to learn that. It's annoying me. It's not intuitive for me because I grew up in an age, Ajay, where we didn't have dial-up. We didn't have internet.
Cool.
You know, and it came in and it was that, you know, on your telephone line. So I am old, but I think the use of technology now is making nature so much more accessible and engaging. And it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? We want people off their screens. We had a talk or chat recently within the Ealing Wildlife Group team about should we print out, you know, work forms or like kind of adventure task lists for kids to go and tick off, you know, species, or should we just do it on a web page? And I was like, no, I want the kids coming to our nature reserves to get off their parents' phones and actually go out and look at things. So paper, but actually the likes of the apps, the ID apps like iNaturalist, Merlin, you know, it's kind of gamifying nature in a way, which I'm all for, because it's getting people to sit up, take notice and go, oh, I never even heard the bird song before, but now that I can hear it and see it happening in my hand and know what it is, I'm suddenly dialed in. And that's adults and young people alike. And I think we have to speak young people's language, and their language is technological. And I think all of these tools we have now to get them engaged and actively participating in nature recording, biological recording, you know, documenting nature conservation successes. We've been trying to adopt all of these different new technologies in the Ealing Beaver Project and allowing our volunteers, including their kids, to come along and be part of recording the success of what the beavers are bringing back. So yeah, I'm all for it. I'm just not very good at it.
But there's something about a clipboard actually as well. If you're kind of filling out things on
a clipboard,
it gives you a sense of a sort of, you know, people look, oh, there's someone with a clipboard.
And, I know, yeah. You look very official. You feel really important with a clipboard, right?
Mm. And wouldn't it be a shame if youngsters didn't get that kind of experience?
I know, and then it's just another screen, another tab open, you know, on your phone, on the internet, and it's forgotten about. But I think there is something really, really exciting in, you know, having that physical quest and taking off a piece of paper like I found this and writing some notes and doing some sketches. You know, we encourage kids to do those traditional ways of recording and engaging with nature as well.
Yeah. And you shouldn't say you're old, really, because I mean, I've seen you do some pretty cool things, you know, trending dance videos and things. You're not a stranger to that.
Oh, that's called a midlife crisis.
But it's reaching people. So
it's reaching people, I suppose. Yeah. Thank you. Well, I'm still down with the kids is what I'm hearing. Yeah.
Absolutely. So kind of wrapping things up, really, in terms of the next generation, we've been talking about this already, but optimism and activism, really. How do you see going from that experience to actually then making that difference?
I have huge amount of optimism and hope because of young people now. I think there's a tendency to focus on the doom and gloom. And, you know, Lord knows we've got enough of it. Like the whole news cycle is constant doom and gloom. And I think we have to be almost kind of aggressively optimistic in our messaging and hopeful in our messaging to try and just get over that and try and basically say, yeah, we know things are bad. We know we're up against huge challenges, but actually, if you talk to young people, they're so dialed in, they're so clued in. And the systems that have led us here to the poly crisis with climate change and biodiversity loss and everything, the systems are, I hope, going to die out. And there's a great phrase, I can't remember who coined it, but it's something like science advances with funerals, right? Not to get too dark about it, but right now, a lot of the decisions that are being made and a lot of the people that are holding power are grossly wealthy, white men largely holding power and patting each other on the back for their technological advances and spending the money and spending their priorities on the wrong things. If you talk to anyone from the age of 30 down, 20, 25 down, they all know that those guys are wrong. those guys are absolutely wrong. And this new generation coming through are going to be the CEOs, they're going to be the business leaders, they're going to be doing things. And I think, by and large, their ethics and their knowledge of what's right and wrong is really, really tipping in the balance of things are going to be okay. I'm constantly inspired by young people's passion and knowledge and optimism and hope. And I think we need to propagate that. And we need to really, really cheerlead them to be the solution to what the previous generations have got wrong. So yeah, I have times where I'm pessimistic and I think, oh God, is this is all pointless? But actually, no, it's not. The new wave along are coming and they're going to get it right. We'll claw it back. We'll have a wilder, freer, more beautiful, nature-entwined life by 2050. I'm confident of it.
I agree, yeah. So thank you to everyone for joining us for Wild Voices, this episode of Wild Tales. You can follow us on Instagram at ntwildtales, and you can listen to more episodes of Wild Tales on your podcast app of choice. Coming soon, we have an episode of London's Parakeets. I know you're familiar with London's Parakeets, so we've got one of those. And also another on barn owls with Jake Brass. But yeah, thank you so much for everyone for listening today. And big thanks, Sean. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's great.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Wild Voices from Wild Tales. We hope you enjoyed the conversation. We'll be back soon with more inspiring stories and conversations from the world of nature. In the meantime, you can follow us on Instagram at WildTalesNT for behind-the-scenes moments from this conversation at the Global Bird Fair, along with plenty more nature stories and adventures. Until next time, goodbye.